Welcome to the first fall 2008 meeting of the Gonzaga Socratic Club. I notice everyone's fanning. The air's already hot in here, even before the philosophers have started talking. That's bad. So we'll have to create a breeze of interest and excitement about this presidential election and connections to religion. The Gonzaga Socratic Club has been operating on the Gonzaga campus now for 4 years. And the club exists to promote open philosophical inquiry into the Christian worldview. We take our spirit and name from the Oxford Socratic Club, which was presided over by the famous Christian apologist C.S. Lewis. Our meeting's topic today is on faith votes, religion in the 2008 presidential election. We're going to have a speaker, and as is our tradition here at the Gonzaga Socratic Club, we'll have a respondent afterwards. Our speaker is Dr. Douglas Kreese, who is professor of philosophy here at Gonzaga. He got his PhD from Boston College. He's been here at Gonzaga University since 1990. He has particular interest in religion and American civic life. And he's done research on that topic that's connected with the famous French traveler and observer of culture, Alexis de Tocqueville. Here at Gonzaga, he teaches courses on a wide variety of things, but particularly relevant to our topic today is our courses that he teaches on St. Augustine and political philosophy. So, faith votes. Religion in the 2008 presidential election, Dr. Douglas Kreese.
We usually don't applaud at the Socratic Club events, but we'll let it go. First of all, I want to explain a couple of reasons why I'm glad to be here and maybe why I'm not so glad to be here. If you have an outline, you can see that these points are mentioned under the introduction. As Dr. Calhoun said, I teach political philosophy at Gonzaga University, and so I ought to be especially pleased to talk with the Socratic Club, because Socrates is said to be the founder of political philosophy. Cicero says that Socrates brought philosophy down from its fascination with the heavens, and that he dragged it right into the cities inhabited by human beings. And indeed, he brought it right into people's own homes, and he made it ask questions about what is good and what is bad and what is just and what is noble. That's why that Socrates is usually referred to as the founder of political philosophy. The political vision of Socrates and his followers was one of great promise. They had this idea that political life should be lived out in a small place, in a city that was limited in size and extent. The citizens in a small political community like this should know each other, and they would know each other, or at the least they would know someone who knew everybody else. They would be engaged in a great task of helping each other live better. Not only helping each other acquire the basic material of life, but actually helping each other improve in virtue. They would help each other grow and develop and become better human beings. It's a very attractive vision that Socrates and his students first offered for political life. On the other hand, I'm not too happy to be here talking about these things, because our topic is presidential elections. And presidential elections are about mass majoritarian politics. And they tend to be kind of vulgar, frankly. Embarrassingly vulgar. For starters, they're massive. You're asked to vote for people you don't even know. How can you possibly choose people you don't even know? Say, well, but we can find out about them. Well, yes, you can listen to speeches, but speeches are always crafted in accord with the rules of rhetoric. They're advertisements. Few people think that truth is to be had from those. Supposedly, the press, the media, is to give us an honest appraisal of these things. I think the ads are probably less biased than media in our time. In the end, it's kind of a shot in the dark, and who knows who you're voting for. It's also, as I said, majoritarian. Okay, the majority rules. What dominates the souls of these people who want to be in the majority? Well, it seems to me that oftentimes it turns out to be kind of a naked, mad dash for power. One needs to be in the majority absolutely and unequivocally. There are no consolation prizes in presidential elections. You know? And in the end, it seems to me that even people who start out with the most noble of aspirations, you know, by the end of the campaign, it seems they're willing to say and do just about anything to get the majority to vote for them. You worry a little bit about the souls of these people, and if not exactly the candidates, the people who surround them. It seems to me they're dominated by the desire to dominate. They're ruled by the lust for ruling, and I just find them kind of embarrassing. Now, Socrates also knew about mass majoritarian politics and Athenian democracy. And in fact, Socrates tried to avoid that kind of politics whenever possible. Indeed, he says that there was a demonic voice that would come to him and warn him whenever he was tempted to involve himself in mass majoritarian politics, the voice would warn against that. When Dr. Calhoun asked me to do this, I was very hesitant to talk about presidential elections. I don't believe I've told Dr. Calhoun this. While I'm not willing to compare myself with Socrates as a political philosopher, that would be hubristic. I too have a little demonic voice that warns me about getting involved in mass majoritarian politics. But when he asked me to do this, I listened, but the voice was silent. And so I agreed to go ahead, and indeed the voice has been quiet all day, and I'm interpreting that as a good omen. Okay. Now, the topic of our talk is faith votes, religion in the 2008 presidential election. So first I want to identify who are these faith voters that I'm talking about. I think the best way to get at that is to turn to the work that's done by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. They've done extensive polling and interviewing of voters of all sorts of persuasions, particularly with respect to questions about religion and politics. On the first level, they simply asked people what religious group they belong to, and then asked them what political group they belong to, and they tried to correlate those things. That's not too remarkable, but what's interesting is that the Pew Forum then began to ask people questions like, you say you're a Presbyterian. Now, how frequently do you attend religious services? Do you pray daily? How important would you say religion is in your life? Questions like this. And then they could correlate not only religious groups with political affiliation, but they tried to measure, it's kind of a crude way, but religious commitments, the intensity of religious commitments, and correlate those with political affiliations. And what they found across the board is that the more voters were willing, the more intensely they associated themselves with their religious communities, the more likely such voters were to describe themselves as conservatives. Conversely, the less interested people were in their religious tradition, the more likely they were to identify themselves as political liberals. Okay? So this is the, on your sheet, I actually typed out the conclusion that they reached, which I'll read. Quote, "One of the realities of politics in the U.S. today is that people who regularly attend worship services and hold traditional religious views are much more likely to hold conservative political views, while those who are less connected to religious institutions and more secular in their outlook are more likely to hold liberal political views." So, I mean, we could say that the liberals have a God gap, that the people who are more interested in God seem to be on the other side. Conversely, we could say that the conservatives have an atheist gap or a secularist gap, because most of the people who fall into that group seem to be on the other side. We can call this a culture war or whatever you want, but the difference really is quite striking. In fact, the single largest predictor of voter behavior turns out to be the frequency with which one attends religious services. It's really quite striking. The gap is greater than with respect to gender, with respect to income, with some qualifications, even with respect to race. Okay, so we have, it seems, secular voters and what do we call them? Faith voters. I would like to also point out that these, there are exceptions. I have two things I want to point out. One, there are exceptions. So if you are I attend religious services weekly, but I identify myself as a political liberal. Or if you say, I never go to church, but I still identify myself as a political conservative. I'm not saying that you don't exist or that you're not unimportant or anything else. I'm just saying, that you're odd. according to the statistics, you're abnormal. The second point I want to make is that oftentimes we think that the faith voters, or at least some people think that the faith voters, are all evangelical Christians. But in fact, it is the case that the evangelical Christians are the largest group of faith voters, but it looks to me as though they're probably not even a majority of the faith voters. The second largest group of faith voters appears to be Catholics. But in fact, this phenomenon where people who are more committed to their faith, or at least are willing to say they're more committed to their faith, identify themselves as political conservatives, that extends along all Protestant groups. It's even true in the historical black churches, this phenomenon of what should I call it, right shifting or something like that. It's measurable, it's very distinct in Jewish communities. Just about every community in America distributes itself in this way. Okay, so those are the people I'm talking about here, and what I'm interested in is what have been their adventures in the 2008 presidential campaign. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if as much as I complain about presidential politics, if decent people don't involve themselves in presidential elections, it only gets worse, right? So I, of course, am not decent people, but I'm interested in those people who... I'm interested in faith voters of all types. Okay, and on your outline, your little syllabus there, the first event that I list concerns the speech of Governor Romney. Now, this happened a long time ago, and maybe many of you weren't even paying attention when it did happen. But it struck me as a much more important event than many of us probably realize. If you remember, Governor Romney, former Governor Romney of Massachusetts, offered himself as a candidate for the Republican nomination for president. As the primaries began, he wasn't doing so well. He wasn't doing terrible, but he wasn't doing as well. Let's say he wasn't doing as well as he had hoped. Some of the polling data indicated that there were faith voters who weren't sure whether they should vote for Mr. Romney because he was a Mormon. And for that matter, there were non-faith voters who weren't sure whether they should vote for Mr. Romney simply because he was a Mormon. So, you know, he realized that he had to do something about this, so he made the journey, and he went down to the Republican establishment in Texas. He was hosted by George Bush Sr., and he gave this speech in which he talked about religion and public life, about being a Mormon and being a presidential candidate. Now, in 1960, John Kennedy ran for the office of president, and as you know, he was eventually elected. There was a concern among many people about voting for John Kennedy because he was Catholic. And so Kennedy had to make the speech, too, in which he tried to explain to the nation why his Catholicism should not be an obstacle to his running for president. I don't remember the speech. I mean, this is even before my time. But if you read about it, what Kennedy basically said was, don't worry, at least this is how it's interpreted, don't worry, I'm going to check my religion at the door. My religion simply has nothing to do with how I may or may not perform in public office. So since I'm going to dissociate myself almost from my religion, except in my very private life, voting for me ought not to be a problem. Now, if you compare that speech with Governor Romney's, a lot has changed. Governor Romney did not say that his Mormon faith was not going to be important in his possible presidency. What he argued instead was that, in fact, in America, there is a kind of loose agreement about faith, or at least about the morality that goes with faith. There's a broad Judeo-Christian agreement about what the proper values, as they usually get called for Americans, what those proper values are. And his claim was not, don't worry, I won't take my Mormonism with me into the White House. His claim was rather, look, Mormonism can fit within this broad consensus of Judeo-Christian values in America. He did not make the claim, in other words, that faith and politics were simply two different things. In fact, just the opposite. I thought, listening to this speech, it was really striking. I expected him to sound just like Kennedy. But in fact, his approach was entirely different. Well, something must have changed from 1960 to 2008. Okay, now the second thing I want to talk about is, I think I listed on the outline, I think I simply say something about Senator Obama. Senator Obama's attempt to build bridges with faith voters. Partly due to the extensive polling that the Pew Forum did in 2007, partly as a response to what they found out, there were a number of groups, Democratic groups, who said, you know, there are too many of these faith voters. We need to build bridges to them if we want to win elections. And so there are many Democratic groups formed, usually under the rubric of centrists or progressivists, who tried to reach out to these faith voters, most of whom, not all as I pointed out, but most of whom identify themselves as conservative. Senator Obama was not the only person involved in this effort, but he was an important player in it. What am I talking about? Well, for example, one of the groups was called Faith in Public Life. They organized what they called a compassion forum at Messiah College in Pennsylvania. They invited Senators Obama and Clinton to participate in this compassion forum. Senator Clinton was still a candidate at that time. And they discussed, well, matters that they argued pertain to compassion. Now, it was a sort of a debate, but more of a discussion about things like AIDS and poverty and so forth. After that, which actually that made that was broadcast on, I believe it was CNN, had exclusive broadcast rights to that event. After that event, Faith in Public Life approached Rick Warren. Now, Rick Warren, I guess I had to do a lot of reading about Rick Warren to prepare for this, so I shouldn't assume that you know about Rick Warren. He's most famous for this book called A Purpose-Driven Life, which I have not read, and I really don't know what's in it. I remember seeing the title, and I thought it sounded like that guy really wants us to work hard, and I didn't want any part of that. So I'm afraid I avoided it, but apparently that's not really what the book is about. In any case, Rick Warren is the pastor of what may be the largest church in the United States, the Saddleback Church. It's an evangelical church. They have 6 services on Sunday. Total attendance often reaches 22,000 people. It's an enormous church. Warren said to the Faith and Public Life people, you know, thanks for the idea, but I think we'll organize our own event. By this time, this happened just almost exactly a month ago, so only Senators Obama and McCain were still running for office, and so they had this interview. The first they interviewed one candidate for about an hour. The other waited off stage but couldn't see or hear what was going on. Then they interviewed the other candidate, asked the same set of questions to each, and the audience was asked not to, you know, hoot and holler or applaud or boo or anything at any of the answers. And so it was very much like an interview that Rick Warren conducted, Pastor Warren conducted with both of these candidates. Now, in the event, a couple of things are interesting. One, in the introduction, before he started talking to the candidates, Warren said flatly, quote, "We do not believe in the separation of faith and politics," unquote. This has become a rather common distinction among faith voters. They'll say, we accept and respect the distinction between church and state, which is, after all, a legal distinction. But the distinction between church and state does not imply an all-encompassing distinction between faith tout court and politics tout court. In the event, people who watched it said that they didn't think Senator Obama looked very comfortable being interviewed in front of this evangelical congregation. In particular, there was a question about abortion that Warren asked both candidates. A lot of the observers thought that Obama didn't seem prepared to answer the question, which is surprising because he had to know it was coming. They thought he seemed evasive. But what I find interesting about this is that Senator Obama wanted to do it. Okay? He wanted to get up there and compete with Senator McCain for the allegiance of these faith voters. Okay, that's the first thing I'd like to notice. Secondly, there were many Democratic insiders after the event who thought, I guess, that Senator Obama didn't do well, and they openly questioned his judgment in even going into this forum. They said he should have known better than to be involved with this. The polls, those all-important polls, because it really is, right, a mad dash for power. These all-important polls indicated after the event that evangelicals were lining up behind Senator McCain after the event. So I guess the impression is that in the end, the faith voters didn't accept what Senator Obama was arguing. I still thought it was interesting that the event even happened. Okay, now the third adventure I want to talk about concerns Governor Palin. Governor Palin, as you may know, was originally baptized Roman Catholic. About the age of 14, she entered one of the Assemblies of God churches, and then, I think it was something like 7-8 years ago, entered a more typical evangelical church. Governor Palin's, the response to Governor Palin was dramatically different, depending upon one's viewpoint. We'll start with the viewpoint of the faith voters. In the eyes of the faith voters, I mean, Governor Palin is more than just a candidate. Okay? She's not a person whose stance on the issues happens to agree with them. She's an icon. And, you know, why is she an icon? Well, she walked the walk. As you may know, the Down syndrome babies are, in our country today, almost routinely aborted. There are tests done before the child is born, the fetus is born. And on the basis of these tests, it can be determined whether the child has Down syndrome, with the idea that the child could then be aborted. And it's very common for this to happen. Well, Senator Palin didn't do that. Now, abortion is a very important issue for many faith voters. But usually, if you're, you know, if you want to be pro-life, you know, you have to say, well, I'm against this and I'm against that, and you have to appeal to, you know, abstract rights and obscure court cases and so on and so forth. But in the eyes of faith voters, well, I mean, here it is. It's right in front of them. This was something to cheer for. They're for the kid, okay, and for his mom and that family. And I mean, that's the political vision that the many faith voters are interested in, right here. So she's not, as I say, it's not just a candidate who may or may line up with one's views, but she's more than that, whatever it is. Okay, so not surprisingly, the faith voters, you know, who were sort of beginning to line up behind McCain anyway, when Palin was selected, it kind of, you know, suddenly the chart was pinned. Now, in the eyes, I mentioned the faith voters before and also the secular voters. In the eyes of a lot of the secular voters, especially certain ones within the Democratic Party, I don't know how to put it except to say that it's not just that they disagreed with Senator Palin. I mean the anger was palpable. Their first response on the part of some of these people was, you know, we don't know who she is, but we hate her, and it's about that graphic. I could give some idiosyncratic stories about this, but I won't. And it is really quite striking, the animosity that was immediately displayed towards her. Now, why is, I'm not really interested in anger, but I am interested in why people are angry. I've got a sense it has to do something about the fact that she's a woman, that she's the wrong kind of woman, that there was supposed to be another woman running for vice president who isn't, that... Did you hear that? The voice is warning me not to continue with this line of examining why people are angry about Governor Palin. Okay, so I better not go there, but I will... the point I want to make about this anyway, I mean, I think you're, Dr. Downey's doing something about race and gender in the election, so you can... maybe the voice won't warn you. I'm not going to go there. But early on in these attacks that were made against Governor Palin, early on the question of religion came up. Okay? Maybe the most obvious thing you noticed was that right away there were things circulating on YouTube, an old video of a time that she was praying before her church, and she had offered this prayer that the war in Iraq might be or would become, or that God could, her prayer was that God could use this war in Iraq, that it could become part of his plan, something like that. And of course the first part was cut out, and so what began to circulate on YouTube was that the war in Iraq is God's plan for the world, something that God wanted. And of course it went from YouTube to the media, and then even when, what's his name, Gibson, Charles Gibson did the interview with her, what he quoted to her didn't, how about this, and left out the crucial part of the quotation. And it's, as she pointed out, it's a prayer straight out of Abraham Lincoln, and she tried to explain that, but that got chopped off. And the net result was it looked like she was, you know, a kind of a mad crusader who, wanted to make war on the entire world in the name of God. And this was just one thing about her religion. Now, in the eyes of faith voters, I mean, when they see that, it looks to them like anti-religious bigotry. It's about that subtle. The net result was that is that see, this is what I don't understand is maybe why Senator Obama didn't rein in some of the people who were saying these things. Maybe he couldn't. Who knows? But it's from watching polls since then. I mean, not the national polls, but polls of evangelical voters, of faith voters, Catholic voters, that they began to line up much more behind the McCain-Palin ticket than the Obama ticket. Now, whether that'll shift back, I mean, I have no idea who's going to win the election. If you came hoping that I would tell you, you're sorely disappointed. I don't know. Okay. Now, I got to conclude here. Here's what I think is going on. And I think I put it on the outline, a Tocquevillian perspective on what is happening. Well, it's according to Tocqueville, the United States had, at least when he wrote his book, the United States had we might call it a sort of civil religion. That is to say, the citizens of the United States all agreed that there were certain principles about morality. There were certain moral teachings, matters pertaining to mores, that we all agreed on and that those had to be observed. Okay? These teachings, as I said, were about morality. Behind those teachings, there are religious doctrines. And he said the Americans didn't really care much what anybody held about religious doctrines. But it was important in their eyes that one believed, or at least feigned belief, in a set of moral teachings. The separation of church and state then meant, according to Tocqueville, that within the realm of politics, all sorts of innovations and creativity were permitted. It was a realm of complete liberty and freedom. But that realm was bounded by a set of moral principles that was not to be questioned, that was not free. A competing view of the relationship between church and state would be that, you know, church is in one place and state is another, and that they're quite separated entities. If you look on my, I drew this wonderful diagram before I started talking. On the right, we have these two circles that are simply separated. Okay. On the left, we have something that I wanted to use to exemplify or to depict Tocqueville's position. In the middle, there is the realm of political liberty. With respect to policy, strategy, and so forth, the Americans, Tocqueville said, have complete freedom. Democratic passions can run wild within that inner circle. But surrounding those democratic passions are certain mores that are not to be questioned. Behind those mores, there are, of course, religious doctrines. Okay? Those do not come into debate in political circles. They are simply left behind church doors. In Tocqueville's time, the question was whether Catholics could be, you know, one of those strange feet in America, whether Catholics could participate in that broad consensus of Christian morality that bounded America. And he thought that they could. It seems to me that what Governor Romney is saying that is that he thinks Mormonism can too. Okay, occupy another one of those outside circles that can support a broad moral consensus that would be on the outskirts of American democracy. There are some people, though, who find that very notion objectionable. The so-called secular... There are people who not only don't agree with Tocqueville's view, but they think it is actually wrong for people to bring faith beliefs into politics. Okay, the secular voters that I mentioned. It's not just that they disagree with them on matters of policy and so forth. They think they're fundamentally mistaken in how they participate in political life. They think it's a foul. It's just out of bounds to permit religious beliefs into the realm of politics. I mean, that's sort of, to me, their view of the relationship between church and state or religion and politics. On the right. And I think what's going on then, ultimately, there are all kinds of things going on, but there's a debate in America about what is going to be the relationship between faith and politics, and the faith voters have one vision, and the secularizing voters have another vision. And how that argument's going to work itself out, I think I better stop there because we want to do some time.
As I noted, our tradition at the Gonzaga Socratic Club is to include a formal response. We value discussion in the Socratic spirit. Our commentator today is Joseph Yee of Gonzaga's Political Science Department. He's been here since 2006 after having previously taught at Oberlin College, Cal State, Fullerton, and Chapman University in California as well. He teaches a variety of courses in political science, including American politics, public administration, and race and ethnicity. He has particular interests in the problems that result from a diverse democratic society, and he's currently completing his first book-length project, which deals with that very topic, titled God and Karate in the South Side. You'll have to ask him about that. He's particularly interested in the pluralistic political philosophy of Canadian philosopher, Catholic philosopher, Charles Taylor. So if you would, welcome Professor Yee for comments.
do a presentation over here for our partisan banner. I have four general points. Professor Creed talked about politics and religion in a very classical sense, and many of the classicals conceive that, you know, in terms of politics, that small and local is better, big and national is burger. But actually, I study American politics, and the American founders had a different conception. Small versus extended republic, and also the role of politics. When I think about the contradictions of democratic politics, I think of that great satire of American life, The Simpsons. And then because one of the conceptions is that politics, especially national politics, mass politics, is burger, that it's all about the lowest common denominator. That, you know, how do you attract Joe Citizen, like, you know, Homer Simpson? You know, what attracts Homer Simpson? You know, Duff beer, right? So you gotta go for the lowest common denominator. Is that what people want? And so basically a candidate that says, or cut your taxes and give you more spending. Right, basically Duff beer. On the other hand, the founders, and also, you know, other examples in history shows that sometimes politicians can appeal to people's, not their basic instincts, but their higher principles. That even a Homer Simpson, there was one of my favorite episodes, Lisa Saxophone. Does anyone see that? Okay. And the idea is that, you know, Homer's an idiot. like a common man or something's idiot. At the same time, the American founder said the common man can recognize virtue, goodness, and others. And Homer Simpson is an idiot, but he recognizes that Lisa is that it has a true talent, has true virtue, and he wants to nurture that virtue. And so, you know, he wants to buy a saxophone, and they don't have the money, so he sacrifices his air conditioner, you know, his air conditioner fund, $200, to buy Lisa a saxophone. And so when I see The Simpsons, when I see Homer, I see he represents the great American citizen. That yes, 99% of the time is an idiot, but there are times of crisis when he says he's a saxophone, and he's willing to chip in and work hard, and he's a loving man. And so when I see that episode, it reminds me of people like Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, because not only do politicians reflect the popular will, they also shape the popular will, especially in times of crisis. They redefine what it means to be America. And before Lincoln, the United States of America was always considered the United States of America are, in a plural sense. Because the founding document was the Constitution, which is basically a social contract among the different states. But then after Lincoln became president, he said the United States of America is. And he referred not to the Constitution, but to the Declaration of Independence. The idea that America is this great moral agent that's going to make, you know, founded on the ideal that all men are created equal. And so he had a new vision for America. He defined what it meant to be a republic. And ever since Lincoln, we no longer say United States of America are, but it is. It were a shining city on a hill. We have this moral mission. And so in a way, it's like, you know, Homer by the second form, right? And people recognized that what Lincoln said was true. It was morally just. And it inspired them to become better than they were. Point number two is that Professor Creed made this dichotomy between there's this common perception today that faith, the more faith you have, the more political right you are. But actually, this is historically a political anomaly. Because if you read like the Making of English Working Class, if you read a history of religion, historically religious people were considered to be on the left. You know, religious, you know, people of faith, they were the ones who organized unions, that went against the big oil companies, that wanted to uplift the people. They were for the common man. It's only recently, since the mid-20th century, that there's been this shift. Religion being associated with the right as opposed to the left, as opposed to the popular left. And actually today, like what the does it mean to be left and right? There is kind of a dichotomy. There's at least two dimensions of left and right, depending on social issues, what they call social issues, such as abortion, and economic issues, more economic material issues, such as nationalizing healthcare. Two big issues this campaign. So let me see now. Left, right. The left, on social issues such as abortion, you're what? Pro? The left. Choice, right? Choice versus life, more communal concept. And then again, on economic issues, people who are on the left are more communal. They want national health care, more communal, national. National health care, whereas on the right they prefer more individual options. And so there are basically four diagrams because they're not necessarily correlated if you look at survey data. So people who are both left on abortion and economics, we would call them libertarians. And so libertarians basically means government out of the bedroom or the border, right? Politically, you could think of people like Barry Goldwater, small government, Ron Paul, or like Eminem, right? You know, don't like government in the boardroom or the bedroom. You know, don't take my money, lots of cuts from me, right? Okay, so, you know, libertarian, live a free life. People who are right, let me see, people who are left on social, people who are pro-choice, but also pro-healthcare, they tend to be the classic liberal Democrats. So those are people like, you know, Hillary Clinton, right? Yeah. Pro-choice, she also wants to nationalize healthcare. On the other hand, people who are pro-life, don't want national healthcare, are those classic conservative Republicans. And that'd be like George Bush, right? But don't forget, we also have this fourth category, which is both pro-life and also pro-national healthcare. Pro-spending for the poor. And these are who? Who's a classic example? You know, who's your shepherd? You know, Pope John Paul is a classic example, and also Pope Benedict today. Pope John Paul, he had this philosophy of the seam of life. The idea is that, you know, we should take care of each other from conception to death, right? So, you know, help the unborn, help the poor. So, you know, this classic example of Pope John Paul, with both pro-life and also pro-healthcare. And you also see this among national politicians such as Bob Casey, who is a senator from Pennsylvania, who is for the working man, the unions, but he's also pro-life. And unlike his father, he was actually granted a speaking spot at the Democratic National Convention. So the Democrats, at least, are recognizing that this fourth category do exist, especially among Catholics. Point number two. My point number three is this God gap that Professor Kreese talked about. Okay, and in a bipartisan spirit, let's go red. Okay. There are actually three ways to conceptualize and to think about the God gap. And the first one is societal. You know, why is there this God gap? Why is there this culture war? Why is there this red-blue divide? And one is that, well, society has changed. Back in the 19th century, you didn't have a culture war because everybody was Christian. And everybody was socially conservative. But then in the mid-20th century, things changed because more and more young people, such as you, are going to college. And so now you go to college and maybe your college kind of corrupts you, liberalizes you. And so college not only does it liberalize people, it also makes social issues more important. So working class people, for the most part, they vote on the pocketbook on economic issues, but educated people tend to vote on social issues, such as abortion. So that's one, that society has changed probably because more and more people are educated. That's been a huge change. It used to be that maybe like 10% of Americans went to college, now it's like more than half from high school. And two is that our political institutions also have changed. And one example is primaries. That before, you know, for example, before 1972, most presidential candidates were selected by insiders. And so you didn't have to really win a primary. For example, Humphrey, I don't think he won a single primary when he was nominated to be the Democratic candidate for president in 1968. But after 1968, starting in 1972, primaries have become very important. And that means that instead of party insiders selecting somebody who they think would have the most popular appeal, now you have party activists who choose, you know, the candidate who's the most pure ideologically. And so with primaries, Democrats and Republicans have become more ideologically pure. Because the idea is that only maybe 25% of Republicans vote in the primary. So according to surveys, 78% of GOP Republicans claim they want a candidate who's willing to compromise. That's like 72-73%. But that means that there's a 25% who don't want to compromise. And they're the ones who are voting in the primaries. And so they're the ones who are, at least in 2000 and 2004, like in 2000, they were going for George Bush against McCain. So McCain won all the open primaries, which included both Republicans and Democrats, but George Bush won all the closed primaries, which were only conservative, which were dominated by conservative Republicans. And because there were more closed primaries than open primaries, George Bush beat John McCain in 2000. Okay. And the third way to think about, you know, the culture war is that, well, maybe it's not society, maybe it's not institutions, maybe it's individuals. Okay? If you have polarizing leaders, it kind of accentuates the culture war. If you have candidates who are more moderate and inclusive, less culture war, right? So for example, you know, Eisenhower, George Bush, the elder, you didn't really talk about the culture war because they were seen as more moderate, inclusive figures. Even Reagan, after the first election, after Reagan, 1984, you know, he was seen as, you know, as a national leader. But especially with Bill Clinton and George Bush, the younger, big culture wars, because they were both seen as very polarizing figures, which is probably reflected in Palin. But don't forget that Palin wasn't John McCain's first choice. Do you know who, if you read the news reports, do you know who was his first choice or second choice? It wasn't Palin. It was actually, Joe Lieberman. Lieberman was his first choice. Palmridge was his second choice. But, you know, they were rejected by the conservative, because they're both pro-choice. They're rejected by the party activists. But imagine what would have happened if they chose Joe Lieberman, who's actually pro-choice and national health care, right? You probably wouldn't be talking about the culture wars today. You'd probably be talking about this kind of post-partisan politics. But it didn't happen. It was very close, okay? Almost, but no cigar. But once again, think about how these three things interact. How society is changing, our institutions are changing, and also how leaders are changing. And also think about how, 2008, people like Obama and McCain, are they polarizing like Clinton and George Bush? Or are they, in a way, more moderate, more post-partisan? They could kind of bridge the divide. So three ways to think about the gap, or the culture war. Now my final point is part four, which is Professor Kreef's question, which is, how do you go beyond the culture wars? How do you go beyond the gap? And this is something that I've been thinking about and researching for my book. How to go beyond the God gap, beyond the God gap, the culture wars. And I wanted to think, and I wanted to discuss this in a historical perspective, which is that you could look at three historical models, and the first model is that you could think of the time of people like St. Augustine, Aquinas, Reinhold Niebuhr, and these were guys who were Christians who connected their Christian tradition, their faith, their doctrines with the modern world. They were engaged with the modern world. Especially like St. Augustine, he wrote in a time of great transition when the Roman Empire fell. And so the Classical Age was the end of the Classical Age, beginning of the medieval era. So he was right in between. And so it's like, and everything's collapsing around him, and he was writing for people. Because there was a void. There was a political, social, and moral void. And he was writing to people everywhere, trying to give them hope that, you know, that Christianity has a message, it does give people hope. And he, look back more recently with Reverend Niebuhr. And again, this was a time, 1950s in America, was transitioning from isolationism to the Cold War. And again, he wrote about how Christianity can relate to this Cold War, this age of nuclear weapons. And how somebody from a Christian background can think about the Cold War, just war, and nuclear weapons, as opposed to just running away from it. So this historical model, Christians are engaged, and they're respected by intellectuals, both Christian and secular. But things changed. This goes to my model too, starting in the mid-1950s, that whereas in the earlier period, Christians were respected intellectual thinkers, starting in the 1950s, a lot of the Christians, both evangelicals and Catholics, were seen as anti-diversity, and basically like know-nothings. That Christians were seen as very reactionary forces. Because I think, for example, today, a lot of our modern institutions, such as university, the mantra is always about, diversity, right? Diversity, multiculturalism, that's a great thing. But then a lot of Christians are very suspicious of that. They're suspicious of all these outside groups, immigrants coming in, outside influences, and so they're seen as kind of a reactionary force. And there was actually an interesting article in the New York Times yesterday about how, this was talking about the Supreme Court. Did anyone read the article? It was basically talking about how the more liberal progressive judges were citing court decisions from other countries, but the more socially and religiously conservative justices, including Catholic justices such as John Roberts and Scalia, said, I don't want to have anything to do with what other courts are thinking about. And Kennedy actually criticized this thinking, saying they're basically like know-nothings. That America's unique, America's unique, we're exceptional, we don't really care, we don't want to really engage with judicial thinking from other countries. And so there seems to be this dichotomy between the modern, diverse, multicultural world and people grounded in faith and tradition. And so you see this tension, and the question is, how do you go beyond it? Because for me, I don't really see a culture war. I just see more of a cultural indifference, because people from these two sides, they just don't talk to each other. So the multicultural, secular, intellectuals, they just talk among themselves, and the Christians, they just talk among themselves. And I should know, because I went to American Political Science Association conference, and I went to both meetings, and I was like the only one to go to both parties. The secular multicultural had lots of food. The Christians, we just have bread and water. The Christians and the political science. But the point is that there's very little overlap. And my question is, so it seems like we're stuck right now. Model two, you see the difference, right? Model one, they're engaged between the Christians and the changing world. In model two, there's this dichotomy, we're separate. Okay? And I think, when Douglas, Professor P and I, we even talked about this in universities such as Gonzaga, that yes, we're considered Catholic university, but what does that mean? How does people who actually believe in, how do Catholic intellectuals make their traditions and their faith relevant to young students today, to people living their modern lives? And so that's the question. And I think to go beyond model two and to go beyond model three, we cannot go back to the past, but I think we can draw elements, learn from the past, and try to think about how we can go beyond the God gap. And I have a couple of suggestions. One is that instead of being like diverse versus anti-diverse, instead of saying diversity means if you liberalize yourself, I would actually argue that, instead of closing yourself off, engage the outside world. And one example would be that there was an incident a couple of years ago where a lot of gay rights activists, they had equality riders that went off to different evangelical campuses, right? And then most evangelical campuses said, no, we don't even want to talk to you. So they basically kicked them out of campus. But there are three evangelical campuses that said, yes, we welcome you to come in, such as Gorman College in Massachusetts. Let's come in, let's have a dialogue. It doesn't mean that we're going to be liberalized and support gay marriage, but it does mean that we're willing to have this kind of dialogue. And I thought that was very refreshing, a new change. Because, especially among evangelical student organizations, and I believe in top university campuses, homosexuality is one issue that really divides evangelicals from the rest of the student population. And that is one reason why a lot of evangelical student groups were kicked out of some campuses, such as University of North Carolina, Grinnell College, because of their stance on homosexuality. So the point is that instead of just being kicked out, let's try to go back in and let's talk about it. And I think some of these evangelical groups and colleges are leading the way. And the second, and my second point is that, yes, politics can be vulgar, but it can also be, you know, beautiful, like Homer Simpson and Lisa. And so, and I think Christians can, you know, by participating in politics, by participating in the, you know, rough and tumble of modern life, that we can try to make politics better. And it makes Christians more mature about how the world works. And one example comes from Rick Warren. Initially, Rick Warren was a classical small government type, saying, you know, government is not the solution, it's the problem. But then he got more involved in fighting AIDS in Africa, he and his wife. And so he realized that, wow, you know, fighting AIDS, fighting poverty is very complicated. And maybe government cannot do everything, but it can do something. You know, government cannot solve all problems, but it can solve some problems, and it can be a partner with different organizations, including faith-based groups. And so I guess for me that means, you know, if you're gonna go to model three, in a way Christians have to learn how to combine engagement with modernity. And this includes you need to combine both excellence plus diversity. Excellence, competence. What I mean is that, you know, especially, you know, these days, a lot of when secular intellectuals think of, like, Christian political leaders, are thinking of George Bush, and you're thinking, like, wow, Christians are idiots. You know, they don't know anything about the modern world. They don't know how to govern. They don't know how to manage in a competent way. So I think we need to kind of transcend those stereotypes and show how political leaders who come from a Christian or any religious faith background can govern in a very effective, smart way. And I'm hoping that people like maybe Sarah Palin or especially like Bobby Jindal from Louisiana can represent that. And the other point is that Christians also show that we can embrace diversity, at least the elements that we think is positive. Because one of the hard knocks on evangelicals and Catholics is that they're basically, you know, predominantly white. That is, especially evangelicals are all white, not that many, there's very little racial interaction, and so they represent the old regime, right? And so it seems to me that, you know, for Christians and Catholics to really, you know, reach out and gain legitimacy, we need to show that we can embrace all different, you know, religions and cultures, but in a positive way. That show, you know, it's like value added, right? Okay. And some examples that I've seen in the real world is, you know, for example, New Orleans, with Katrina, Republicans, George Bush got a real hard knock. But today, there's a real renaissance happening in New Orleans and Louisiana, especially with schools. You know, Bobby Jindal and also the New Orleans School District, they're doing a lot of things. They're doing school vouchers, they're doing charter schools, they're working at parochial schools, religious schools. So it's like a new model of doing politics, where government is willing to partner with different organizations, including faith-based organizations, and they're willing to hold them accountable to get good results. And I think Christians should get involved in that kind of political system. We should hold ourselves accountable, and we should work hard to show that we can be both competent and also embrace diversity. So anyway, these are just some ideas that I have. And the final thing I want to kind of draw to you is that I think Christians can learn from our changing complex plural world, and especially from outsider cultural traditions, because I do think that many, if not most Americans, do feel a certain social and moral void in American society. Society is changing, and we're kind of shaped, we're not really on solid ground. So we're looking for something to kind of fill that moral and social void. And I think this comes, and I see this especially with the popularity of karate and martial arts, especially with martial arts movies. And my two favorites are Karate Kid, you see that? And Matrix, right? Karate Kid and Matrix, and because for the most part, you know, there's Christian culture and secular culture, but outsider traditions such as karate bridge those two cultures. And if you look at Karate Kid and Matrix, it was hugely popular with both Christians and non-Christians alike. And I'm hoping that Christians can involve and get involved and create, you know, new cultures, new combination that could bring different people together. Okay, so anyway, so we're going to open it up to questions and let's have a quick discussion about, you know, God gap and how to go beyond the God gap. Thank you.
We do want to include also your questions and comments, so the floor is open. If you want to direct your questions to one of the speakers, please do that. Go ahead.
You suggest that Christians and secular Baptists can come together.
Yeah.
But the way you're suggesting they come together is they come together to pick up. What about the idea that perhaps, like you suggest, government isn't the answer, and there might be a different way you can come together without resolving the
issue? Sure. Well, that's why I talk about the model of New Orleans and New Orleans and Louisiana, because maybe after I answer this, maybe we think about, if not big government, what kind of, what would be the ideal role of government, in your opinion, and also, you know, what would be the role of faith organizations? So maybe some thoughts. But, just, because I'd like to get your take on it too. But in terms of Chris, this relationship between secular and faith, actually build on Charles Taylor, what he argues, because he really argues for mutual interdependence. That we're not, that we're not all divided and we're not indifferent from each other, that we really need to depend on each other to survive and prosper. And the specific example that I have in mind is that a lot of secular intellectuals, they really need people of faith to understand the modern world, that the rest of the world, which is heavily religious, right? So I would argue that it's actually easier for a Christian person to talk to a Muslim person than for a secular person. Do you think? Because a Christian person understands what it's like to live and have faith. And so he has some common understanding, some common ground to talk to a Muslim person. And actually when Muslims critique America, they're not critiquing America because they think it's a Christian country. They critique America because they think it doesn't have a soul. That is a secular, totally secular Jerry Springer society. Okay? And there was this quote from one of the bombers. In 1993, there was a bombing of the World Trade Center. Okay? And then one of the terrorists, he was quoted by saying that, why you hate America so much? And he said, America's like an empty pan. Empty pan. It looks great on the outside, it's very shiny, but inside it's empty. It has no soul. And so you cannot just bomb people and try to persuade them that way. That's a technological intellectual solution, secular bombs. You need to, in the long run, you need to change hearts and minds. And one way to do that is by using people, people of faith, whether they're Christian or Muslim, who can talk to these terrorists and understand where they're coming from. That's part one. And part two is that, conversely, people of faith also needs more secular institutions and organizations. Because I do a lot of work with Christian organizations in Ivy League campuses. And one problem is that a lot of the Christian organizations have a tendency to insulate their people from the larger society, because they think society is corrupt, we should just hang out on their own. But when you have that kind of insular churches, insular Christian groups, this leads to potential abuse of authority. You isolate your members, it almost becomes like a cult. And so when I see Christian groups like that, I feel that that's why it's very helpful when you have government faith-based initiatives, because it holds these different Christian, it connects Christian groups to a larger society, and it also holds them accountable. One of the groups I was involved with was the International Churches of Christ. There's a chapter here in Spokane, the Spokane Christian Church, and they were a very gung-ho evangelical group, but they also isolated their members from the rest of society. But one way that they did manage to connect themselves was through faith-based charities, faith-based partnerships, and through those faith-based partnerships, Christians felt connected, and they learned from the rest of society. And I'm hoping to build those kind of partnerships, because I don't want secular, because I think there is a mutual dependence. And I think with this kind of mutual dependence, we both prosper. Okay. Does that kind of help your question?
To a certain extent, although I think to an extent with that openness on the part of the Christians, the religious society be undermined by current movements such as the New Atheists, Richard Dawkins and that sort of thing. Wouldn't that seem to sort of undermine the capacity for trust in the Christian side if we feel like they're so under attack from the secular side?
Well, I go back to Lincoln and just talk about the rough and tumble of democratic politics, which is jump in, get engaged, try to see if there's areas of common ground, like specific projects, such as fighting AIDS in Africa, or educating low-income black children in New Orleans. These are specific projects where secular liberal government is partnering with faith-based organizations and Catholic schools to make real difference in people's lives, whether in Africa or in the inner city, you see? And in the process of partnering and interacting with each other, people learn from, this is a transformative process, that, wow, secular, it's like when you meet somebody who come from such a very different background, and you learn and you realize they don't have horns, you learn something from that process.
Yes, so I think my real issue with all of this is you make it sound as though this is something new to religious believers. Whereas evangelization has been going on for years. We invented the hospital.
Yes.
So
right.
And so forth. It's something new, it's been going on, it's
Right, since St. Augustine, right. Well, that's why I talked about my three historical models, right? And I talked about, for most of history, Christianity and Christians were engaged in the modern world. But I'm saying that this cultural war, this dichotomy between liberal modernity and people of faith, is actually kind of a historical anomaly, you know, since the mid-20th century. And I'm saying that, you know, in a way, we need to kind of go back to the norm. You see what I'm saying? I'm saying I guess I'm pointing out that, you know, this is actually a fairly recent, well, anyway, so.
I would agree with you, it's a recent phenomenon. But why is it recent? It seems to me it's recent because there are a group of people now who are vehemently anti-religious and don't want religious people to be part of the conversation when it comes to politics. That's where the novelty, to me, comes to the fore. Religious people always talk about politics before, and now there are some people who don't want them to be talking about politics. And that's what I find. At present, I mean, who knows what will happen, but at present, it seems to me that's why the conversations have an impasse. Let me just add, I guess, one question or comment I'd like to point out, Dr. You use the example of Homer and his daughter Lisa. And Lisa is Homer's daughter. When you ask me if I watch TV, I sort of consider that an insult. What are you going to accuse me of next? That's my point, okay? Even a slob like Homer Simpson would do something noble for his daughter. If we're talking about a small political reign here, people are able and willing to do things for each other. You ask for these dialogues among religious groups and so forth. Well, in order to have a dialogue, I need to be able to talk with one-on-one. I can't have a dialogue with a cast of thousands. And that's why I think it's important to return more to the smaller political unit where dialogues really could go on. I'll leave it there.
Sure. Open it up, throw things at us, rough and tumble.
No problem.
Okay. Rhetorically.
You can yell, but no problem.
Yes, sir?
It seems like Christians are always being asked to compromise their beliefs, where on the other side, on the secular side, tend to hold their own beliefs and not really compromise them as much as Christians are asked to. So how can we, who are Christians, engage in a debate, say on moral issues or social issues such as abortion, where there's not, I mean, either believe that life begins at conception or you don't, there's not much middle ground to work there with, but it seems like we're being asked to compromise on our side, whereas the other side isn't being asked to compromise as much. So how should we work through these difficulties of sort of mutually exclusive sides of the debate, I guess?
That's a hard one. It strikes me that, well, I'm not sure, but some secular voters don't seem to care as much about abortion as, say, do many, not all, but many faith voters. And so it strikes me that, well, maybe they should compromise on that one if it's not that critical to them. It does seem to me that the Democratic Party can win any election at once, any time, simply by nominating pro-life candidates. And I think they can always get an option of the others to vote along with them. It's these moral, what faith voters care about are morality. And that's what I think secular voters don't realize. To them, abortion, for example, to use what seems to be the flashpoint issue, that's just one more issue in part of a long list of issues. The issues are ranked according to the faith voters. There's some that are more important than others. Use the example of health care. Well, I bet if you talk to the faith voters, I mean, they're all for everybody having health care, and they probably have different views on how you could arrange it. The principle that's not negotiable is that we shouldn't, that is the principle that we should just a matter of policies, okay? And so they don't mind compromising at that level. But at the level of moral principle, whether we should help, there they don't want to compromise. So, I don't know, maybe if it seems to me that the secular order might have an easier way out there. And I should point out that in the 2006 elections, congressional elections, okay, there were a bunch of pro-life Democrats who got elected. That's always there, but in American politics.
But. Sure. And then I think the national media and also our system of political primaries tend to accentuate extremes, hard secularists versus a hard Christian. But in reality, there's a lot of moderation in between.
Neither of these groups that we're talking about, either the secular voters, the liberal secular voters, or the conservative faith, neither of those is a majority. And neither of those can simply get them away.
Sure, and also none of them are monolithic. Internally they're very diverse. And then that's one of the reasons why I study, because I don't specialize in media and politics, because they're always just shouting at each other. I teach public administration, because I'm interested in policymakers, governors, mayors. We actually have to get different people together, not only to form political coalitions, but they also need to form governing coalitions to actually govern and get things done. And these are the people that's actually on the localities and states. They're the ones that actually bringing different religious, cultural, business, civic groups together to actually, make a real positive difference in the lives of people. And this is what you see in New Orleans and Louisiana, where you have a Democratic mayor, Democratic superintendent Paul Vallis from Chicago, and also Republican governor Bobby Jindal, who's working together to provide not only school vouchers, but also charter schools to help inner city kids. And two is that if you look at important institutions such as Brookings Institution, Brookings is probably the most famous liberal secular institution. It actually cannot even support a school voucher, saying that this is going to make a real difference in the lives of poor kids. And so when I see maybe in terms of media you see a lot of polarization, but in the actual realm of public policy and administration, you do see a lot of common ground. Does that kind of help? Sure.
I have a comment, or a question. Dr. Freese declined to predict the outcome of the election, and you didn't offer to, so we'll take that as an indication that you're not playing prophet here. But I'm curious what you two think. When you got to your third model, I thought that you might invoke Senator Obama there, but you didn't. I wonder, how do you think he's doing as a post-God Gap candidate, either one of you?
I know, because I have my red pen on, so,
Okay.
Maybe kind of move. Okay.
Well, I guess I sort of said in my talk that I think he made an effort in the campaign to build bridges to religious voters. I really, from the polls I've seen, those efforts pretty much went up in smoke with the Palin nomination, and particularly religious voters viewed the attacks on Governor Palin as being, anti-religious bigotry. And the religious voters, they still could change their mind or something, but at this point are pretty alienated from the Obama campaign. That doesn't mean you won't win the election. You don't have to have religious voters in order to win. But I don't think that those religious voters, the faith voters, are going to vote for him. Except, I should qualify that, black faith voters, from all accounts, are wonderful for Senator Obama.
Sure. Just a couple of suggestions in terms of future politics. One is that black faith voters are actually very interesting, because if you look at their attitudes on church attendance, and also social issues, actually more socially conservative and more religiously active than white evangelicals. But they're Democrat for historical and racial reasons. And so in a way, they serve as a very nice bridge between the liberal, between the secular left and the religious right. And you see this
If you look at that Pew Forum poll, this phenomenon of what I call right shifting. And that is to say, the more that one is involved in one's religious community, the more one is willing to identify himself as a conservative. That happens within the historically black churches as well. So there are a lot of, I'll call them faith voters in historically black churches who self-identify as conservatives. They also self-identify as Democrats. And that's very interesting.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's why I see African-American faith-based voters as playing a very bridging role, because right now a lot of mainstream evangelical churches, such as Rick Warren, they're heavily reaching out to Hispanics and African Americans, because their vision is that in the 21st century, the true evangelical church will be multi-ethnic, will be multiracial. The true Catholic church will be multi-ethnic, multiracial. That is a future vision, right? And
well,
as
probably already real in the Catholic church.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Right. And so my prediction is that as these formerly white evangelical churches become more multiracial, and as they get more African Americans, you become politically cross-cutting and rich because of the fact that, because I see this in my research, as you get more African Americans in the church, and they get involved in things like AIDS or poverty education, they become more sensitive to the role of government in social services. So I'm not saying it's going to make them more Democrat, but I'm saying that it does make. As white evangelicals develop social relationships with black evangelicals, it does make them more sensitive to the role of government in society.
Yeah.
So I do see,
I don't see how that overcomes the division between faith voters and secular voters.
Well, because secular voters, they're very like PC, and also they're very racially inclusive, so they want to do things that's going to help the African American community. This is what I see among liberal Democrats, among my liberal
Democrats. But if the African Americans are still faith voters, what are they going to do about that?
Look, the point is that if you look at specific policies such as school vouchers or especially charter schools,
yeah.
For example, the secular left historically opposed charter schools. Teachers unions don't like charter schools. They want, straight public schools. But then because there's tremendous support in the African American community for school vouchers and also for charter schools, it has led politicians such as Obama to come out and support our charter schools. So I see, them as this is just a potential bridging ground,
mm-hmm.
For the Democrats.
So if they set aside their sort of fundamental differences, they could work together on a particular a particular policy.
Right.
You would say, that's true.
And in the process of doing so, they realize that, well, maybe we have, there's more that unites us and divides us. In the long run, we'll see.
But that one I find harder to accept than maybe.
Well, we're out of time. You can continue the conversation. Please stick around. Let's thank our speakers.